Steve Marshall.
I mean, I think we have a strategic plan in place. There's an argument that there is some systemic problem within all of our facilities, and I wholeheartedly disagree with that. We dare defend our rights. That is a motto of the state that I think matters. We have the opportunity to push back against what we think is an overreach of the Department of Justice. We don't necessarily embrace the fact that Washington, D.C. has all the answers. We want to be able to do it ourselves in ways that we think make sense for Alabama. And in fact, the governor's plan demonstrates that.
That's the Alabama Attorney General. As we wrap up, Andrew Jarecki.
Yeah. I mean, that experience of talking to him was just remarkable because it's a kind of government speak that is devoid of the humanity of it, right? Whether he's visited the Alabama prisons or not, sort of irrelevant. He is the person that's running the justice system in that state, and he's obviously doesn't believe that there's a problem.
30 seconds. Solitary confinement. Who's in, who's out right now?
Melvin Ray has been released. Robert O'Counsel and Raul Poole are still in. And what I would just say is we made this film over 7 years, but the issue in Alabama's prison is still very urgent and very current. Since 2019, 1,500 people have died. And as you can see, they are threatened by voices that speak up. They are an authoritarian power that wants to quell dissent. That is what some of the people in our film are dealing with right now. And so I hope that people will watch, go to our website. There are ways to take
You're action. Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Queery. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Queery every third Saturday at 10 p.m. On your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And I lose control.
Venezuela get its oil industry back online. Again, nothing wrong with that. That will help the Venezuelan people. So again, Petro did not sacrifice his principles in this meeting. And so that's where I think the victory lies.
Well, I know that Petro has also talked about drug trafficking in the region and has specifically talked about, you know, the how the problem with drugs is not just a regional problem, but also involves Miami and Dubai. You know, reports from the summit say Petro gave Trump a list of real drug lords who live in Miami and Dubai, trying to flip the narrative that Colombia is the problem. You've written about how the war on drugs is a Trojan horse for counterinsurgency. Does Trump actually care about cocaine, or is this solely about breaking the sovereignty of any nation that dares to trade with China or support Palestine?
Yeah, no, I think it is that it is pretextual in the way you said. I don't think the U.S. really cares about drugs. If it did, Trump wouldn't have pardoned the former president of Honduras, who was convicted of major drug trafficking. Right. We know the CIA itself has been involved in drug trafficking to aid the Contras, to aid South Vietnam during the war there. So I think it's a canard for sure. And yes, Petro was direct. He said, hey, we're happy to go after the heads of the cartels in Colombia. But he said, look, those are the minor players. The big players, like you said, are in Miami and Madrid and Dubai. And that's the truth. And he said that to Trump. So, again, he was very pointed in that position.
Well, let's go back to Venezuela here for a second. It's been over a month since the U.S. abducted Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores on January the 3rd. The media has sort of moved on, but the reality on the ground remains the same. With Delcy Rodriguez now sworn in as president in Caracas, has the U.S. achieved its goal of regime change, or have they just created a martyr? Is the resistance inside Venezuela hardening, or is the country fractioning as the U.S. seems to have hoped?
Yeah, well, it's quite obvious that there was no regime change, right? It was a change in faces, but Delcy Rodriguez is a longtime Chavista, ally of Maduro. She's made it clear she's going to continue his policies. So in that sense, the regime change operation failed. And yeah, it looks like, in fact, the revolution, the Chavista revolution, is deepening, that people are rallying around the government. There was a vote of the House of Deputies that voted unanimously to condemn the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro and his wife. And that included votes by some anti-Maduro congresspeople. So I think all that Trump has done is solidify support for the government.
We know that Venezuela was a major economic lifeline for Cuba and shipping oil in exchange for doctors, largely. With Maduro gone and Venezuela's oil infrastructure under U.S. control or blockade, what happens to Havana? Are we looking at a special period on steroids for Cuba? Is the ultimate goal of the entire operation not just Caracas, but the final strangulation of the Cuban Revolution?
Well, yes. I mean, the Trump administration has made that clear. I mean, they're talking about regime change by the end of the year. Clearly, that is the goal. And clearly, Cuba is already in the special period on steroids. I mean, it's very clear that their economy is in desperate straits. It needs fuel to keep the electricity on. And the U.S. has been very good at bullying many countries into not providing that fuel. Russia has agreed to continue providing fuel. We'll see. We'll see what Cuba can do. But it is a very desperate situation the U.S. has put Cuba and its people in. And there's a lot of suffering in Cuba due to this. And that people have to realize that. It's people, it's women, it's children, it's vulnerable people who are suffering the most from this blockade.
Well, it's pretty easy to feel a little bit pessimistic about that. This has been going on for what, decades, right?
I mean, yes.
This has been a full court press against Cuba for decades. This just seems to be, you know, this Trump again using the bully pulpit, but also gunboat diplomacy and big stick diplomacy, bringing that all back in a real naked, aggressive way. And I don't know about you, but I've been really surprised that there hasn't been a more virulent reaction by Latin America, from Latin America. And I wonder, how do you view that? Why is, you know, if this had happened 20 years ago or even a decade ago, there would have been a very different reaction. Why are we seeing what we're seeing as far as the region, the response of regional leaders vis-a-vis Trump's current aggression in the region?
Well, it's a good question. I think you're right that we're not seeing the resistance that we usually expect out of Latin America. In fact, you see the contrary in some countries, right? You see Chile that just elected this right-wing president. You saw in Costa Rica, they just elected a right-wing president. And there seems to be a shift to the right to some extent in Latin America when in fact there had been a major shift to the left after Chavez was elected in 1998. Why is that? I think, you know, in part it's because some of the governments that claimed to be left-wing weren't that left-wing and didn't deliver for the people in the way that the people wanted and deserved. I think the U.S. has done a good job of, you know, infiltrating these countries and supporting right-wing movements that have predominated. And I think there's fear. You know, there is fear of the United States, of the Colossus from the North and what it could do to people. Those are some of the reasons anyway. I think we're seeing what's happening. But I don't count the resistance in Latin America out. I do think that you will see that resistance rise. I do think that. It may take some time, but I do expect it. And I honestly think Petro will end up being a leader of that resistance.
And you're listening to Flashpoints, and that's the voice of Dan Kovalik. We're discussing Latin American regional politics, really vis-a-vis this new context of Trump's nouveau Monroe Doctrine, big stick gunboat diplomacy that's going on in Latin America. Well, you know, I think back at Nicaragua, and I think about what might be deemed the Sandinista solution. When the Sandinistas were faced with a similar onslaught from the U.S. government, there was a Reagan administration then, and similar threats, they permitted elections on U.S. terms, and that brought in Violeta Chamorro. You probably recall this as well as I do. And now we see this complete cycle occur where Daniel Ortega is returned to power and ostensibly with the same set of politics, although some have argued that his politics have changed and the politics of the Sandinistas have changed since then. But I wonder how you sort of look at that. And are we seeing the possibility of a so-called Sandinista solution, support for elections by the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela?
Well, perhaps. I still support Daniel and the Sandinistas. I don't think their politics have changed. I think their style has changed, but not the substance. I still think they are defenders of the poor and working class in Nicaragua. And it shows that Daniel has 85% approval in Nicaragua, staggering approval rating. And yeah, in some senses, well, first of all, you know, clearly the elections in 1990, the results came about because truly Nicaragua, you know, the U.S. put a gun to Nicaragua's head.
Right.
But as you say, the Sandinistas, notwithstanding that, they stepped down. I think you could say they then went into an organized retreat to some extent, but though they quietly continued to organize. And then they came out on top, I think 17 years later, again, by quiet, continued organizing of the masses. And yeah, it shows that you can sometimes... Again, I gave it at the outset the military kind of analogy. Sometimes you need an organized retreat. You need to survive to continue fighting. And yeah, that may be an option for different movements in Latin America.
On the other hand, we had the example in El Salvador of the FMLN attempting a similar electoral strategy and an utter failure in that regard.
Yes, they've been roundly defeated. There's no question about that. I think that's due to its own internal problems, divisions. They weren't able to find unity within that organization.
Unlike the Sandinistas and Ortega and Nicaragua.
That's correct. And again, I think the left in the U.S. doesn't give Daniel enough credit for continuing, for maintaining the unity of the Sandinistas.
It's interesting because I see some of those folks, I hear some of those folks on the left playing right into the State Department line of dictatorship in Nicaragua.
Yeah. Well, it's absurd. Again, he has massive support. He's done a lot for that country under amazing pressure from the United States. You know, this goes back to Michael Pereni, we were talking about before we got on. I mean, as Pereni would often say, and even in the context of Nicaragua, you know, that the American left, they just, you know, somehow the successful revolutions, they somehow are critical of and suspicious of. They seem to almost applaud failure. You know, they like the failed revolutions, not the successful ones. You know, successful revolutions are successful because the leaders know when to compromise, when to fight. You know, Danielle is someone who was able to do that. Petro is someone who's able to do that. That's great leadership. You know,
so you're making the real politique argument, right?
It's, you know, we live in the real world. And if you are a leader of a country and you care about your country, you do what's necessary to protect the country, to keep the revolution going. Yeah, I am just in awe of leaders like Daniel Ortega and Petro and Fidel Castro. I mean, they led successful revolutions. I think we can learn a lot from them.
You've also argued that we're seeing the most aggressive application of the Monroe Doctrine in a century. And
yes.
Now we have the kidnapping of a head of state in Venezuela, threats against Mexico. And now what some of the Trump administration are arguing is the pacification of Colombia. Where is the international outcry? The UN Security Council met last month and did nothing. Has the rules-based order officially collapsed into might makes right?
Well, I think it hasn't collapsed. It's been...
It's always been that way.
And the U.S. has taken a sledgehammer to it. I mean, let's face it. It's not that it collapsed internally. The U.S. has acted in ways intentionally to destroy the rule of law in the world. And yes, I think you largely see the rule of law broken. I mean, honestly, the fact the world has done nothing to save Gaza is probably the starkest example of that.
Stain on humanity.
And yes, it is a stain on humanity, on the United Nations, on the world community. And yeah, that the world has allowed a head of state like Maduro to be kidnapped. I mean, it's an outrage. And yeah, where is the outrage, though? It's deeply concerning.
Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, some folks will, and myself, I agree, knowing that history, that, you know, this has always been this way. There's always sort of been this liberal veneer, sort of what Mark Carney called out in Davos, right? That it really never was a rules-based order. It always was might make right, that they merely had better messaging, better comms to cover up their misdeeds. I mean, come on, you know this history. Jacobo Arbenz, right? From Jacobo Arbenz through Jean-Bertrand Aristide to Nicolas Maduro, the U.S. has for decades overthrown democratically elected governments, forced thousands of families, thousands more people to suffer as a result of U.S. foreign policy. So in that way, it is true. It's not new. It's just that now we have a different sort of stripped naked version of it.
To some extent, that's true. I mean, obviously, the examples you give are, you know, proof that the rule of law created by the United Nations after World War II was never truly put into effect. And again, largely because of the resistance of the United States. But I think there were some checks on U.S. power. Obviously, the Soviet Union was the biggest check. And the collapse of the Soviet Union really allowed the U.S. to do as it has wanted to do. And it's made the world a lot worse off. But I do think it's a matter of degree. And I think the degree of lawlessness that the U.S. is showing over time has increased.
Lawlessness or impotence?
Well, lawlessness, I mean, you know, the blowing up of these boats in the Caribbean, just murdering people.
Well, that's again, the Trump administration, but that's never officially sanctioned by the UN. The UN is just sort of impotent in the face
of... Well, that's true, but I meant, yeah, the U.S. is acting in a lawless way, and the UN is doing nothing to try to stop it. And it has tools to do so. Even though there's a veto at the Security Council, the General Assembly has a tool called a Uniting for Peace they could use to overrule, or actually to essentially take on the power of the Security Council to maintain international peace and security when the Security Council is bogged down by vetoes.
So then one could say, based on that it's complicity.
Well, yes. I'm surprised that Uniting for Peace mechanism was not used to do something in Gaza, that it hasn't been used to do something to stop what's happening in the Caribbean. So, yeah, I do think there's a certain amount of complicity, for sure.
Well, Dan, you often make the connection between what happens there and what happens here. Trump is using the Alien Enemies Act to justify mass deportations at home while he invades countries abroad. Is there a direct link between the destabilization of Venezuela and Colombia and other countries in the region and the refugee crisis that Trump is now exploiting to militarize the U.S. border?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, you know, war is what caused, you know, is the biggest cause of migration. And the U.S. is constantly at war and is causing migration problems, not just in Latin America, but in the Middle East. And then it uses the migration, as you say, to justify, you know, violent policies at home. But I think the other, you know, the other link to be drawn is the destruction of the rule of law, you know, as seen in the kidnapping of Maduro, the murder of people in the Caribbean. Now we're seeing complete lawlessness at home, you know, as you say, with people being detained totally arbitrarily, many citizens being detained, with citizens being murdered on the streets of Minneapolis. There's no very, very little stretch from, again, bombing boats who you claim of people you claim to be drug traffickers. There's no stretch between that and, again, shooting someone in Minneapolis with no legal basis. So that's the world we live in now, a world without law, either international law or domestic law.
Well, it's also interesting to me, and I wanted to ask you about this, which is that in wars such as Afghanistan, probably one of the starkest examples most recently, there was a National Guard shooting, and it was a suspect who served in a CIA counterterrorism unit called Zero Units inside of Afghanistan. And it's interesting that the CIA will also help to bring in those individuals and their families who worked for them in the field in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. But it also seems like ultimately they just sort of set them free on their own and there's no oversight or follow-up, particularly with psychological disorders, which, you know, PTSD, which our own troops suffered from. So you can only imagine what the CIA operatives went through as well. People who were involved in what some might deem criminal operations on behalf of the U.S. government and other countries, and just sort of letting them free in this country without any oversight. And that's rarely mentioned.
Yeah, well, it's very true. I mean, the hypocrisy there is just incredible. And it just shows immigration isn't the real issue that Trump cares about. I mean, I truly think that these ICE operations, you know, as the days go on, it's being shown it isn't about immigration as much as it is just terrorizing the population,
right,
at large, immigrants and citizens alone. Both, right? So I think that's the goal. I think the goal is to use immigration as an excuse to militarize the cities. Yeah, and to terrorize and put down the people. That's what I see is happening.
So this boomerang effect that we've been discussing it for decades, as I recall, right? And I guess a real central question is, can people in the United States, if their government does not respect sovereignty and human rights abroad, how can they possibly expect them to respect sovereignty of communities and individuals in this country, right? That there's a direct connection between the unfettered power of U.S. foreign policy in the way that our government acts in our names and crimes that it commits, and that this makes the same treatment of our own people more likely here at home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I go back to Gaza. I mean, when you see the brutality that the U.S. is supporting in Gaza, just the, you know, the genocide against the people, you know.
Horror.
There's no way that that isn't going to be brought home. And that has been brought home. And you're going to see more and more brutality by the U.S. state forces against the American people. I think those things are connected.
Well, I'm going to close on this final question, Dan. In the face of this overwhelming force where presidents are kidnapped and neighbors are forced to negotiate, where does the hope lie? Is it in the streets of Bogota, or is it in the is it in areas like multipolar alliances like the BRICS nations?
Well, I think it's maybe in both, but I think it's also on the streets of Minneapolis. I mean, I think the resistance you're seeing to ICE in Minneapolis is beautiful. I think it's, you know, the people of Minneapolis are really defending all of us and the rights of all of us. But yeah, I mean, I think it is going to be in the streets of Bogota, Minneapolis, New York, you know, everywhere. In the end, it's going to be the people that are going to prevail and defend the rule of law, to defend human rights. That's the only place, I think, in the end that it will be defended.
And there are plenty of organizations in the United States on the left who have direct ties to all these different groups in America Latina, right? I mean, it's actually a huge, rich network in many ways. How do we get that to get more traction? How do we get people to start to do their homework, to start to see those connections here in this country, in the so-called, as Michael Parenti and others would say, the belly of the beast?
Yeah, well, I think it's programs like this one. I mean, we have to do the education. I think a lot of people are doing it through books, through podcasts, through this. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the only place, through social media. Mm. I think that type of education work is important. I do think it's being done. I think the American people are starting to get clued in to what is happening, and they don't like it. And that's positive. That's very positive.
I agree with you. Well, we're going to leave it there. Again, that's the voice of Dan Kovalik, good friend of this show. We've been discussing Latin America as well as its connection to domestic policy here in the United States. Dan, you know, always a pleasure, and I hope that we get to come back to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kevin.
You're listening to Flashpoints.
Si te has vuelto a equivocarte, has vuelto a pisar en falso.
Mira.
Has vuelto a dejar desnuda tu cabeza en el cadalso. Se han vuelto a quedar sin alma los ofensores del pueblo. Tu obsesión por el dinero, tu oficio de vende patria.
Dale agua a ese dominó.
Que si el juego se te tranca, no le eche la culpa a nadie, y por Dios.
Se acabó nuestro tiempo. Nunca olvides que quien paga siempre en el traidor desprecio.
Y yo no entro en tu juego.
Rentabiliza la mer, la arrogancia del imperio. Rentabiliza mentir por confundir.
Rentabiliza cantar que estás contra la pobreza. Si en terciopelo y satín se revuelca tu vileza,
de esa forma te desprecian, así tarifan tu honor. Los que te rentan la voz, los que te incitan a odiar.
Dale agua a ese dominó.
Si a ti la vida te estresa y la coges con tus hermanos, no sabes de dominó.
Dale agua a ese dominó.
Son 62 victorias, 62 mil te esperan, millones diría yo.
Rentabiliza el charrudo sobre tu patria y tu tiempo. Vana ilusión de poder, triste modo de estar muerto.
Espero que tengas fondo para hipotecar tu tiempo.
A la revolución le queda 62 mil milenios.
And welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. While the world's eyes are fixed on the U.S. kidnapping of Venezuela's president and Trump's incessant gunboat diplomacy, big stick policy in the region, a quieter, deadlier war is being waged just 90 miles from Florida. The regime change operation in Caracas wasn't just about Venezuela's oil. It was about cutting the lifeline to Cuba. With Venezuelan energy shipments now blocked by the U.S. Navy, the island is facing its darkest hour since the special period in the 1990s. The lights are going out, the blockade is tightening, and the Trump administration is going in for the kill. But the Solidarity Movement is not staying silent. Joining us for an urgent update is Onya Sawu Chatoyer and Cheryl Labash, the co-chairs of the National Network on Cuba. They're coordinating the resistance inside the U.S. to break this siege before it turns into a humanitarian catastrophe. Welcome to Flashpoints.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with you, Cheryl. Let's start with the immediate impact. The U.S. strategy has always been to suffocate Cuba by cutting off its partners. Now that the U.S. controls Venezuela's oil terminals and has stationed warships in the Caribbean, what are you hearing from your partners on the ground in Havana regarding the energy situation and the daily struggle for survival?
Well, they're planning. That's one of the strong points about Cuba, is they are a planned society. They're planning for taking care of the basic needs of people in this new situation. And they're ramping up solar and other ways of providing energy for the people. This is not a situation where the Cubans are going to bend under pressure from the United States, no matter how much pressure they apply. I think the Trump administration thinks that somehow by pushing genocide, actually, on the people, announcing it plainly and clearly, declaring that Cuba is an enemy, that is somehow going to make Cuba become a vassal. They fought too long and too hard. They are making plans. They're adjusting day-to-day life, but they are ramping up solar, and they are ramping up biogas and other methods of providing energy for the people.
Well, Onyan Sonwu Chatoyer, we spent 4 years demanding that Biden remove Cuba from the state sponsors of terrorism lists. Now that designation is being weaponized by the Trump administration to block even basic humanitarian aid from reaching the island during this crisis. Can you explain to our listeners why this specific designation is so deadly? How does it freeze banks and scare off food shipments right when people need them most?
Well, Biden did actually remove Cuba from the state sponsors of terrorism list. He just waited to do so until he was going out the door. I think it was only a couple of days before his administration ended. And with that very, very temporary removal of Cuba from the SSOT, the Biden administration released a statement or a report basically saying that there was no evidence whatsoever that Cuba was not providing sufficient aid in the war against terror, or that Cuba was providing material support for terrorism. So the U.S. government, not that long ago, openly admitted that there's no basis for this accusation that Cuba is aiding or harboring terrorists. However, what Cuba's listing on the SSOT means is that nations around the world and corporations and companies around the world that would like to do business with Cuba, that would like to engage in trade with Cuba, are frightened away from doing so, because if they take the risk of trading with Cuba, they also chance that they are going to be prosecuted or face large fines from the U.S. government. And so in order to avoid that kind of hit economically, they preemptively just do not engage in trade with Cuba. And the consequence for the Cuban government and the Cuban people is vast shortages, is a lack of access to liquid funds that they need to buy resources to maintain the needs of their population. It basically escalates the economic isolation of Cuba that is the intent of the genocidal U.S. blockade.
And that is the voice of one of our guests today, Onya Sonwu Chatoyer. She is, along with Cheryl Labash, co-chairs of the National Network on Cuba. They're coordinating resistance inside the U.S. to break the siege on Cuba before it turns into a humanitarian catastrophe. Cheryl, despite the threats, your organization, the National Network on Cuba, is escalating its work. You have the Lives versus Blockade campaign, I understand, and the Off the List petition, which has gathered global support. What acts of defiance are you planning right now? What acts of resistance can people participate in this country? Are there emergency brigades or aid caravans being organized to challenge this new naval blockade directly?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there are material support, medical aid primarily, that are being organized throughout the United States. Already there's been one caravan that has gone from Los Angeles to Florida to be put on a ship and sent to Cuba. There is another one planned. And then there are cities throughout the Midwest going to the South, and from the Northeast going also to the South, to bring material aid that's been collected in many different cities, from many different sources, really touching base with medical professionals, clinics, places where medicines and medical supplies can be gathered. In addition to that, there has been several national and international campaigns to provide medical supplies for Cuba. There is the Hatue Project that raises funds to bring specific cancer medication, pediatric cancer medicines that save children's lives in Cuba. And there is another campaign that is raising money for sutures. How do you have any kind of surgery if you don't have sutures to be able to stitch people up after the surgery? So these are important campaigns that are going on and will be ramped up. Everyone now is alert to this emergency. We're not going to allow Cuba to be beaten. A victory for Cuba surviving and thriving means that we can also survive and thrive here in the United States.
And Onya Sanwo Chatoye, I'm wondering, you know, I'm also hearing from my contacts in the Caribbean that the Trump administration is pressuring other governments in the Caribbean to end the, for example, Cuba has trained doctors throughout the Caribbean region. In Haiti, I can think of that in particular, Jamaica as well, but also has had literacy campaigns that they have helped to develop in order to lower the rates of illiteracy across the region. What is your sense of those governments themselves resisting this pressure from the Trump administration? It seems as though a few of them have already capitulated and others are considering capitulating to Trump.
Well, I think we have to consider the impact of U.S. hegemony, meaning that the dominance that the U.S. Empire has over the economic system, the global trade system, and also military power worldwide means that when nations are considering whether they have the capacity to stand up against the U.S., they have to take into consideration the fact that the U.S. has the power to tank their economies, to tank their currencies, to arrive in their nations in the middle of the night and kidnap their president. Yeah, so this is the reality of the world we're living in now, and the escalation of U.S. imperialist hostility to the rest of the planet. I think that a lot of nations, like Mexico, for example, would like to present a kind of stand to these U.S. government attempts to extort people away from being in solidarity with Cuba. But the risk they take if they do so is massive. And so what it really indicates is that we need to start building movements, popular power across borders, so that when nations are standing up against the United States, they're not standing by themselves.
Well, Onya Sanwo, let's make the argument to people in this country why it's important to support Cuba. What do we have at stake in that, in if Cuba falls?
I mean, first and foremost, Cuba is on the front lines of the global struggle against imperialism, and that can sound like really abstract, particularly if you're not familiar with what imperialism is. But basically what it means is that we are living under a global economic system that is destroying the planet that we need to live, that is causing suffering for a majority of the Earth's population, and that is failing to provide, even on a basic level, the material needs of the people living inside the United States in every single kind of way. way, we are getting a raw deal. And so what Cuba represents is an alternative to that system, a project that is centered around life and centered around connection and centered around solidarity instead of around profit and greed and growth. And for those of us living in the belly of the beast, seeing what's happening with the mass deportation programs, the brutality of ICE and the entire Department of Homeland Security apparatus, we need an alternative to look to, but also to learn from, because we are going to have to organize movements for justice in the United States that can replace this system with something better. It's literally about the future of life on this planet, but it's also about the future of our day-to-day lives, the future of our loved ones and our families and our communities. Like, Cuba provides an example that we must learn from and emulate, and it has to be protected.
Well said. Well, we only have about a minute left. Cheryl, for people listening who are watching the dominoes fall in Latin America and feeling helpless, what's the single most important thing they can do today to join the NNOC and stand between the empire and the people of Cuba?
Contact your local Cuba Solidarity Organization if you need help finding one or organizing one yourself. Contact us through our website, nnoc.org. NancyOcuba.org, and we'll help you.
Fantastic. Again, that's the voice of Cheryl Labashe, and we've also been speaking with Onyesam Wu Chateauyer about support and solidarity with Cuba, the importance of the example of the people of Cuba, and how we can stand up for them against our own empire, which threatens them daily. Thank you so much for joining us today here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoints.
Trump crossed the line, did it in our name. Started an illegal war, lit the fuse to flame. No Congress vote, no allies called. One man's ego and the bombs just fall. Kidnapped a leader, stole his wife. Called it strength, put the world on ice. Said I run Venezuela now. Said trust me, it's fine. Said America first, but mend his design. No law, no check, no plan at all. Just power drunk and the next hard fall. If this ain't criminal, then it's insane. Either way, it's not okay.
Remove him now.
Remove him now. Before there's nothing left to remove him from.
Remove him now.
Say it loud. 25th impeachment. Indict him now.
Remove him now.
Says America first, says it with a grin. But every country with America is fair game to him. From Canada down to Chile's shore, he talks like the West is his to own. No mandate, no crown, no throne, just a loud man out of control. This isn't leadership, this is theft. This is what happens when power's unchecked. Every day stays, the damage grows. Every lie he tells, the line erodes. 3 years left is a deadly span when war's decided by one man.
Remove him now.
Crime, illegal war, cross the line. No delay, no excuse. This is what the law is for. Not revenge, not revolt, just the rules he chose to ignore.
Hey, 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 hey.
Whoa.
Remove him now.
Well, Welcome back to Flashpoints. For over 150 years, the 14th Amendment has been the bedrock of American identity. It's a single sentence that promises that if you were born here. You are a citizen. It was the amendment written in the blood of the Civil War to ensure that a former slave class could never be stripped of their rights again. But now, the Trump administration is preparing to take a red pen to the Constitution, a legal trick designed to retroactively strip citizenship from millions of children born to undocumented parents. This isn't just immigration policy. This is the creation of a permanent caste system. It is a legal mechanism for what some are calling administrative ethnic cleansing. Joining us to defend the 14th Amendment is Shahid Buttar. He's a constitutional attorney, a relentless civil liberties advocate, and the former director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He knows the Constitution better than the people currently trying to shred it. Shahid, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. You're very kind and warm in your introduction. I appreciate it.
Shahid, let's start with the mechanism. President Trump claims he can end birthright citizenship with a single executive order, bypassing Congress and the amendment process entirely. As a constitutional scholar, walk us through the legality of this. Can a president simply reinterpret a constitutional amendment out of existence? Or is this a blatant usurpation of power that the Supreme Court will have to stop?
This is very much a blatant usurpation of power that I fear the Supreme Court will rubber stamp. Ultimately, the executive order that is at issue in the case coming before the court, oral argument is scheduled for April 1st. That executive order was issued on the first day that Trump took office. And it's never taken effect because it's been tied up in the courts. And this is what that looks like for that to untie itself. The Supreme Court has already heard a preceding case last year. And in that case, while it did not reach the substantive legality of the administration's attempt to remove the 14th Amendment from the Constitution, what it did rule in that case was plenty catastrophic in itself. Last summer, the Supreme Court limited the power of lower courts to issue injunctions that take effect across the country. In other words, the Supreme Court hamstrung its own branch. And when you think about I wrote an article about this on Substack some time ago, the balance of power among the branches, the separation of constitutional powers between the executive, judicial, and legislative branch, that's a big theme of the Constitution. In fact, perhaps the core point of the document in the first place. And nothing gives the president the right to disregard such fundamental constitutional provisions. In that respect, it's entirely on brand for this administration because blatant usurpations of the law, of course, that's, you know, the president's MO ultimately.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. That's the voice of my guest, Shahid Buttar. We're talking about Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship. Well, I got to say, and it feels to me white supremacist. You know, it feels to me as if this is part of that underlying ideology that is sort of never talked about, which is this is about fear of people of color having more power in this country than white people, right?
10,000%. And it is absolutely white nationalism being expressed through the law. There's a term that's gained increasing prevalence, lawfare, which is sort of like the use of the law as a instrument of war. And if you go back to the 60s and 70s, there was a school of thought that recognized very much that the law is nothing more than a medium for power exchange and mediation and legitimation of oppression. And in this context, what we're seeing through the effort to erode birthright citizenship is very much the legal sanction for a white ethnic an ethnostate. Mm. The principle that if you're born in the United States, you belong here, that's been a bedrock defining feature of this country for the last century and a half. And it is a little bit glib to note how many different principles we've won through blood and tears and sweat and sacrifice that our country has been so casually willing to disregard in the recent past, right? When Bush started torturing people and Obama said it was okay, that was like losing the Second World War. Right. The mass surveillance regime is kind of like losing the Revolutionary War. And if this case if the executive order that is upheld by the Supreme Court in Trump versus Barbara, that will be the legal equivalent of unwinding the Civil War.
The entire legal argument from the right hinges on four words in the 14th Amendment, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. They claim this excludes children of undocumented immigrants. You've studied the history of the Reconstruction Amendments. Was this phrase ever intended to exclude immigrants, or is this a deliberate distortion of history designed to turn the children of workers into stateless ghosts?
absolutely a contortion of history. In fact, the Justice Department, Trump's Justice Department, filed a brief earlier this month in this case. And in it, they just blatantly cherry pick, I think it was something like a dozen different leaders at, you know, random points in the past. The arguments aren't even internally consistent. And it was absolutely understood at the time of the Reconstruction Amendments that if you were born in the United States from that point forward, you would be a citizen. And there was no intended exclusion of immigrants. There was a subsequent history with respect to, I'm thinking, for instance, of the Chinese Exclusion Act. There was a lot of legislative activity to limit immigration, but none of that touched birthright citizenship. So it's absolutely a contortion of history. There's a further point here to be made, which is just that the contrivance of this argument, the argument hinging on those four words, is itself ultimately just a pretext, right, to, and you touched on this in your earlier question, a pretext to ethnically cleanse the United States over time. And the concern, of course, and you hear this, there's the great replacement theory, it's referred to among right-wing circles, that, you know, because there are more people of color ultimately than white people in the world, if we have immigration that allows any kind of migration, the white country that is the United States is doomed. But even that is a contortion of history, because this country's never been a white country in the first place, right? There were indigenous people here long before there were white people. There were black people here as immediately upon the founding, and immigrants have come here from every corner of the earth in the last two centuries.
It's really about power, right?
Entirely, and exclusion.
Well, if this order goes through, we weren't just talking about closing the border, right? We're talking about millions of people who grew up believing they were Americans suddenly losing their rights. What does a day-to-day reality look like for these people? Do we see the revocation of passports, the denial of social security numbers? Are we effectively creating a massive stateless underclass that has no legal right to exist in the only country they've ever known?
So some yeses and some noes to those different questions. I don't think that the implication, if Barbara versus Trump, if the executive order is upheld by the court, that in itself won't necessarily deprive people who have already been granted citizenship any number of rights. But given the pattern of this administration, you can absolutely see those further steps coming that would do precisely that. I think a lot of people assess politics and constitutional law as if it were static and not a dynamic vector. And when we think about this case in the context of the Roberts Court's broader jurisprudence, which has included a multi-spectrum and sustained attack on democracy from, you know, the predecessor to Roberts was Rehnquist, as Bush versus Gore, that just, you know, decided an election in spite of the popular vote. You move to Citizens United, which basically subverts democracy to capitalism. The case is immunizing the president for crimes in office. You know, the Roberts Court has been dedicated to centralizing power in the executive branch, exactly what the Constitution was designed to stop. And in that context, I think those further fears that you articulated are ultimately, should the court allow the executive order to ever take effect, those further steps, I think, are effectively inevitable.
Well, Shahid, you've been a fierce critic of the Democratic establishment for years. We had 4 years of the Biden administration before that, the Obama years. Why was there never a push to codify this right or strengthen the protections for these families when they had a chance? Is the current crisis partly a result of a bipartisan refusal to fix a broken immigration system?
It is not only a result of that refusal, but it's a result of that refusal over the course of at least 30 years. For a generation or more, Democrats have claimed to support immigration reform while tepidly advancing very meager proposals and ultimately caving in the face of right-wing resistance to continue funding enforcement without any reforms to guarantee rights. So, you know, the buzzwords in Washington under Obama, this is 15 years ago, were comprehensive immigration reform. And the idea there were to create a bunch of rights and tighten enforcement. And instead, all we've gotten over the last generation is the ever increasing, not just tightening of immigration enforcement, but its pretextual use as a lever to create a paramilitary force answerable only to the president being deployed across cities and across the United States to suppress constitutionally protected dissent. So much worse merely than tightening enforcement. Meanwhile, there's been no expansion of rights and a pretty profound limitation of them over time. So the Democrats have absolutely been complicit. And every time Democrats have funded DHS, what they have effectively done is empowered this process, the right-wing weaponization of immigration against not only immigrants, but also the constitutional rights of all of the American people. And that is a pattern in which Democrats have been complicit too many times to count, unfortunately.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, but if this executive order is signed tomorrow, what is the immediate move? Beyond the courts, which are increasingly packed with ideologues, what can communities do to protect their neighbors? Is this the moment where sanctuary cities have to move from passive non-cooperation to active resistance?
I think we're past that point. I feel like we are already past the point at which we can pretend that the law is going to protect anyone in this country, and it is entirely up to communities to protect their most vulnerable neighbors. There are efforts in communities across the country to do exactly that. You know, we've all read the historical accounts from figures, I'm thinking of Anne Frank in particular, and yeah, we might be at that point to shelter your neighbors and protect them from the state. I don't think that the outcome of the case changes that. I think we crossed that Rubicon a while ago. Just to quibble a little bit, the executive order got signed a year ago. It was the first, one of the very first things that Trump tried to effectuate when he came to Washington, and the only thing stopping it from taking effect have been these legal challenges. And the courts have been so committed, seemingly, to supporting the right-wing attack on our rights that when this case came up before, they hamstrung themselves. I mean, and just the extraordinary pattern that that represents, the idea of an institution constraining itself is fairly unprecedented. They don't typically do that, right? The whole point of the Constitution was to set up branches that fought for their own prerogatives. And the court seems to be so deferential to the administration that when this case came up before, the court was like, not only are we not going to rule here, but we're going to hogtie all the lower courts and limit the power of judges throughout the system to respond to injustices and ensure that they can only issue injunctions constraining executive branch agencies within the particular districts of the court. And that has implications far beyond birthright citizenship. I mean, in some respects, that is a constitutional revolution in itself. So much so that what we're looking at now, you know, sort of has a character of fractals, you know, sort of one thing compounding another.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Again, that is the voice of Shahid Buttar. He's a constitutional attorney, a relentless civil liberties advocate, and the former director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Can't thank you enough.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure, Shahid. Thank you.
That does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
I'm Mr. KBOO Portland. Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934